The House Judiciary Committee for Friday, April 20th, 2007. Committee members, we have a long agenda here today, and we also have some other commitments that are going to be having members coming in and out. It is my intention to complete today's agenda because we don't have a constraint at the far end because of no floor session this morning, and because we have big agendas coming up next week. So we need to really clear our decks to get into that final week for House.
Chair McPherson,
we
only have a clear deck because some of us anticipated you saying we probably will go long today.
Very good. Well, I appreciate that. And just to roadmap it for the committee and for people here in attendance, I intend to do the public hearings first because we're going to have members coming in and out, and I think that we may have more members a little later in the process, so we'll be going back to do work sessions on the four bills that are scheduled for work session and for the bills that we have held public hearings on here that merit further action. And I'll be taking those in the order in which they're printed on the printed agenda. So I will begin by opening a public hearing on House Bill 3026. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, and members of the committee. House Bill 3026 relates to the existing Class B misdemeanor of failure to maintain a metal purchase record. And I should note for the record that the summary that I'm going to give is based on the bill itself. I received the Dash 2 amendments late yesterday afternoon, so some of what I say about the summary is not going to be accurate. There are enough people speaking who know a lot about this bill that can correct what the Dash 2 amendments do. I haven't had a chance to go through it in full detail. Some of it I have. In any event, existing ORS 165.107 creates the Class B misdemeanor of failing to maintain a metal purchase record. This offense relates generally to the problem of drug users, oftentimes methamphetamine users, financing their habit through stealing and then recycling metal. The focus of the statute is on the metal recycler dealer. Rather than allowing a sort of no-questions-asked commerce in what are called non-ferrous, meaning not containing iron, scrap metal, the dealer must record certain information about each transaction. Presently, the dealer must retain the following information for at least a year and make it available to any officer. 1, a description of the property purchased. 2, type, quantity, weight of property. 3, the name, address, and signature of the seller. And then 4, the type of vehicle and license plate of the seller's car. House Bill 3026 makes several changes to ORS 165.107. First, it replaces the word person in existing law with metal recycler or secondhand dealer. The Dash 2 amendments use a different term. I believe the only term they use is scrap metal dealer. And that is defined as a person engaged in the business of purchasing or receiving non-ferrous metal property for aggregation and sale to a metal processor or metal recycler. In addition, House Bill 3026 removes the existing requirements of what needs to go into a record, and it replaces it with the following. First of all, the dealer needs to record the date and time of the transaction, name of the person conducting the transaction for the dealer, general description of the property, including any discernible marks, a copy of the seller's license, passport, or identification card, the amount of consideration given, if it's over $100, a declaration by the seller that the metal was not stolen, video surveillance of the seller receiving the consideration, which, according to the Dash 2 amendment, needs to be retained for 30 days, and then the vehicle and license plate of the seller. In the original bill, House Bill 3026 enhanced the existing offense of failing to maintain a metal purchase record from a Class B misdemeanor to a Class C felony if the person had 3 priors. I believe, and I will be corrected if I'm wrong, that the Dash 2 does away with the criminal components entirely and uses fines. The first three offenses would be $1,000 fines. Once you have the 3 priors, it would be a $5,000 fine. And that's everything.
Very good. Thank you, Council. We have several of the sponsors of this bill here this morning, and I'd like to invite them to come forward. I see Representative Breen, Representative Schaffler, Representative Olson, and I don't see Representatives Boone and Clem in the room. If I'm mistaken, they are certainly welcome to come forward as well. But these three of our colleagues can give us some introductory remarks.
I'll start if I may. Is that?
Yeah, great.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm Scott Bruin from House District 37, which is primarily Tualatin and West Lynn. And before I start, I just want to say that after hearing the long scope of the of your day here in Judiciary, I'm really disappointed I wasn't assigned to this committee this year, but you know, better luck next year. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I've submitted written testimony. I'm not going to read it. I just want to cover some highlights very quickly. First of all, I want to thank the real workhorses behind this bill, a number of industry groups, nurserymen among others, that have really worked hard to form a consensus and a coalition on this bill, an industry coalition, a bipartisan coalition. You can really tell by where the bill is now how much work and effort and thought has gone into this. As was well described, this basically increases the penalty. It makes it more difficult to sell stolen metal. It makes it more difficult to sell stolen metal and does that by a number of methods. And let me tell you why I am so interested in this bill becoming law and why I was drawn to this. Some of you may know that in my other life, the one that actually pays the bills, I work for a commercial construction company. And construction in the construction industry, we have forever had to deal with job site workplace theft. It's just part and parcel to being in the construction industry. Years ago, it was anything that somebody could sell in a pawn shop, honestly, or anywhere else. It was tools. It was anything else. In recent years, and I would say, you know, you try to be precise, but I would say the last 6, 7, 8 years, we've seen a real shift in what's being stolen. We're actually seeing times when tools are left untouched in a job site, and the only thing they're stealing are the metal products. They're stealing wire. They're stealing rebar. They're stealing very expensive finished metal bars and beams and whatnot. And it's become a very expensive, very pervasive problem in construction, and is leading to, we all know, we've heard about the massive escalation, inflation of costs in construction. This is a part of that. This is a significant part of that escalation in costs. I'll share this very briefly. We had an interesting example at my company last year. Our company is headquartered in Southeast Portland, and it was a Sunday morning about 7 o'clock. That a gentleman backed a pickup truck, an old beat up pickup truck, back to the gate where our yard is, used a big pair of bolt cutters, broke into our shop yard. I want to say this was probably May or June, so about a year ago of last year. Broke into the yard, opened the gates up, went and gathered all the metal products that he could carry as one man to put them in the back of his pickup truck. It took about 20 minutes for this guy to do that. And you may ask, how do I know the detail to such a degree of what he did? Because our camera that was hidden was staring, looking at him the entire time that he was doing this. And it was very interesting. Once again, it was very early Sunday morning in sort of an industrial area, so there wasn't a lot. There was no people around. And he would come around and look to see if anybody's looking. Every time he would come to look outside, he's looking right into our camera. It was wonderful. And so when we discovered this on Monday, we, of course, turned it into the police, and the police loved it. They actually sent it out to all the news stations. So on the Portland Metropolitan News stations that day, they ran this guy's face clearly and visibly for everybody to see. It was wonderful. And the police got this guy within 2 days. And the point to this is this person, who's now in jail, was known for stealing a variety of products, but also metal, and using that to sell and to buy meth. And that's just a specific example with my particular company on the much broader, much larger problems of metal thefts and theft in Oregon. So I just appreciate the committee hearing this. I think this is a wonderful step that we have to take. It's both a step to reduce meth crimes, and it's a step to protect private property, and I would encourage your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative from the Albany area. But I got invited to this task force that was working on this about halfway through last year from a perspective of law enforcement, then also being part of the legislature as well. Some of the things that I can share with you from previous experience and everything is that as this bill would have greatly helped a few years back, from my observation, in the agriculture part. It was difficult to see somebody go out into a farmyard in a pasture with a chainsaw and start cutting up irrigation pipe and then throwing it in the back of their pickup truck to go sell. And then, you know, depending on where they went, they could sell that product. This is going to help greatly, I think, to deter that type of effort. Besides the agriculture, you have the utilities, just as what Representative Bruin talked about, the construction part, but you also have the transportation end of it as well that are extremely important with this whole issue. So at this point right now, this is what you have in front of you, and I'm pleased to have been part of the work group to have worked with it, and urge an aye vote for this. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Schaffler, State Representative, House District 48, Happy Valley, Southeast Portland, and I appreciate you giving me the offer to come here, and I also want to appreciate this committee and all the work, the workload you do, and I would like to single you out, Mr. Chair. You also are co-chair on Measure 37. You have to be one of, if not the busiest legislators in the state of Oregon, so I appreciate all your efforts. I'm in full support of this bill. I, too, have experienced theft of tools, equipment, and materials on a job site. They will steal anything that is not nailed down. And especially if you show up one day and your rain gear isn't there, and you got to sit there all day all wet. That kind of a why they would steal my old ratty rain gear is beyond me, but it's happened. So I'm in full support of this. I also want to recognize Jeff Stone from the Nursery Association. He, I believe, presided over this task force, and I want to thank all them, too, as well. I'm here just to lend moral support and my full support of this issue so we can stem the tidal wave of methamphetamines here in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Terrific. Any questions? And colleagues, thank you very much for your leadership on this issue. It's really an important one, and the energy you've brought to it, I think, will get us to a good place. Our next panel will be Kevin Kleppinger, Mark Hopkins, and it looks like Gary Burnt or Brandt from PacifiCorp. You gentlemen decide the order of presentation.
Okay.
Works for me.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Kevin Kleppinger, General Manager of Evergreen Nursery and current Chair of the Government Relations Committee for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. This morning, I represent over a dozen natural resource organizations which uniformly support a sensible approach to fight milk theft. Irrigation pipe, sprinkler heads, copper wire, located in machinery has become a target of thieves, and the problem is only getting worse. In many cases, nursery owners and operators deal with crime as a cost of doing business. This is not right, and the OAN felt that addressing metal theft in a meaningful way was a priority for the association. That has brought us to today. I am pleased to testify in favor of House Bill 3026 with the -2 amendments. I appreciate the leadership and support of Representatives Bruin, Schaffler, Olson, Clem, and Boone. Mr. Chair, I submit a letter to the record supported by the natural resource portion of the coalition. It is our opinion that the rise in methamphetamine use is a key reason for an increase in metal thefts in agriculture and other industries. Since last summer, a remarkable coalition has emerged. As you will hear following my testimony, sectors such as construction, utilities, metal recyclers, and law enforcement, in partnership with agriculture, has met, discussed, argued, and compromised on a common set of needs and objectives to stem the theft of metal from our business. This coalition has collaborated on the product you see before you today and committed to work with each other in the coming years to address additional measures necessary to grapple with this issue. All the sectors involved have been victims of metal theft. All the sectors believe the time is now to act and take a significant step toward providing tools to combat this crime. House Bill 3026 is a small yet powerful bill. It clarifies the metal purchase record and embodies the responsible business practices of our metal recycling partners. The bill calls for purchase records to have a useful description of the load, a copy of a driver's license or state-sanctioned form of identification, and utilize video surveillance and retain the images for 30 days. This effort, and I give a lot of credit to the metal recyclers and law enforcement working together, is a big step in reversing the metal theft trend. Simply put, this bill focuses on the point of transaction. Metal recyclers who knowingly accept stolen material will be held accountable. The revolving door for metal thieves who see too few deterrents will have serious consequences. There's a lot to say on this bill, and the partners following my statement will amplify many of the positives of HB 3026. The coalition intentionally developed our approach to minimize the bill's fiscal impact. There were a lot of terrific ideas, such as a data collection system, the establishment of regional law enforcement personnel dedicated to metal theft crime, a central multi-industry alert system, and a host of other measures that require us to roll up our sleeves, work together, and seek funding in the 2009 budget. We did not think it would be fair to ask for it all when the coalition and the legislature must take its first step. House Bill 3026 puts teeth and clarity in the metal purchase record and metal theft law. It is a reasonable bill that begins to realistically address a growing solution to a critical problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your attention, and would encourage the committee to support HB 3026 as modified by the Dash 2 amendment. I'm happy to answer any questions and have Jeff Stone, ULEAN's Government Relations Director, available as well. Thank you once again.
Thank you, Mr. Clevenger. Mr. Hopkins.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Mark Hopkins. I'm the Corporate Safety Manager for EC Company, a Portland-based electrical contractor serving customers in Oregon and the country since 1946. EC Company provides electrical services in the commercial, industrial, telecommunication, civil, and federal, state, and local government construction sectors. And we have projects at places such as hospitals, banks, high-tech facilities, roadway signals and lighting, mills, factories, schools, colleges and universities, stores, office buildings, airports, military, and power generation facilities. In addition to the safety of EC Company employees, metal theft is a primary concern for me and my company. Daily, EC Company deals with non-ferrous metals such as copper and brass that hold values which continue to inflate on world scrap metal markets. Because of scrap metal price increases, EC Company has seen an increase in metal theft on our construction projects and maintenance job sites. EC Company engaged in nearly 1,000 construction projects of varying size nationwide last year, and we estimate our annual direct and indirect costs associated with metal theft to be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. One theft last year illustrates this problem very well. At one of our hospital projects in the southern Willamette Valley, a substantial theft of large-gauge copper wire occurred. The thief tore down the security gate, broke into our storage connex to obtain tools which were then used to hotwire our forklift. The forklift was used to lift the 5-foot in diameter reel of ground wire onto a vehicle. The 1,500 feet of wire was valued at over $10,000. In addition to the value of the wire, other associated losses included costs to repair damage to our connex and forklift, non-productive labor hours needed to report the theft to law enforcement and assist with the connected investigation, replacement cost of the stolen wire, lost schedule penalties incurred because of the 6-week lead time needed to order and replace or needed to order and receive the replacement wire, and associated indirect costs involved with the redirection of our construction crews away from ground wire installation to other tasks. The total loss to EC Company for this single theft is estimated at $75,000. The general contractor also incurred loss associated with damage to his fence and resultant investigation, and two other specialty contractors had tools and equipment stolen at the same time. There was a good outcome to this incident in that the perpetrator was caught when he tried to sell the stolen copper wire cut up in 5-foot lengths to a scrap metal dealer we had notified to be on watch for the wire. In cooperation with that dealer, the Linn County Sheriff Department made an arrest. The thief was tried and convicted, and as this was his third metal theft offense, he was sent to 13 months in prison. The original and replacement cost of the wire and other associated costs, though, have never been recovered. Metal theft is so prevalent on construction sites that most companies don't spend the time to report minor thefts or calculate the costs associated with them. Because of the fast pace of construction, only large thefts, such as the one I just described, are worth the return on investment of time and company resources needed to report and investigate them. Commercial construction insurance policies rarely cover these losses because of high per-incident deductibles. These losses affect the bottom line, and as a result, jobs are at risk. In addition to the direct impact to jobs, EC Company has had to invest tens of thousands of dollars in job site security to ensure that work progress made during the day is not ripped out and destroyed at night by metal thieves while the job site is vacant. Outreach to neighbors to act as site observers and expensive security systems will not, however, dissuade a determined metal thief. Metal theft is an issue EC Company has been battling for the 11 years I've been with the company. I first became interested in the concept that is now House Bill 3026 last year when I was invited to participate in a work group pulled together by the Construction Industry Crime Prevention Program. The legislation before you today is the product of many interested parties coming together to solve a problem. It is the kind of collaboration I like to be part of. House Bill 3026 seeks to bolster the details contained in the metal purchase record, increase penalties for convicted metal thieves, and heighten the purchasing requirements of scrap metal purchasers. This is a huge step forward in curbing the metal theft issue that is plaguing EC Company and the construction contracting industry. EC Company is supportive of House Bill 3026, and I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to voice my support for the bill, and I look forward to answering your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins.
Can I just
Dennis Barker.
Thank you. And so you have a $75,000 loss. Do you know what the $10,000 spool of the wire, what would that, I mean, the guy cuts it up and it's scrap. What would he get for the scrap value of that? Do you know?
It'd be the approximate, well, the price at that time was over $3 a pound. The weight of that was I'm going to just guess because I don't actually know the exact weight, but it was certainly probably several thousand pounds.
Okay. Thank you.
So a significant amount of money.
Next, we'll hear from, is it Gary Berndt?
Gary Berndt, yes, thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committees. I welcome the opportunity to testify this morning. I'm the Director of Corporate Security for Pacific Corps. As I suspect many of you are aware, Pacific Corps is an electric utility company that operates in six western states. We have over 1.7 million customers across those six states with over 520,000 customers in the Oregon area. Pacific Corps supports this bill, House Bill 3026, but I also represent other utilities in the Oregon area, and as witness to that, you do have a document that is a joint utility letter that talks to the fact of why we're supporting this as an industry. From a Pacific Corps perspective, we feel that this bill brings greater accountability to the transactions around metal and purchase and sale of scrap metal. And it also brings, we think, more deterrence to the criminals that are engaging in this activity because of the tougher sentencing. We've talked a little bit about the price of copper, which has been a significant driver, so I won't spend too much time on that. Would like to talk a little bit about the financial impact that this is having on Pacific Corps. Across the six states that we operate in, last year we estimated over $500,000 in losses in terms of dealing with the labor that it takes to restore broken fences, gates, replace the material that's been taken. And within Oregon, we estimate it's been over $150,000 in terms of losses that we've experienced around these type of events. Just a quick story. In the Bend area, just to demonstrate that it's not only a financial loss, but within Bend, we lost some temporary material that can be used to construct transmission towers, about $50,000 in material. But the significant thing from a reliability perspective is that this material has about a 6 to 9 month lead time. So we were in a position where, had we had a significant outage that required the installation of temporary transmission towers, we may not have been able to respond, or we may not have been able to respond very quickly because we'd have to move this material from another part of the region or another state. So there is the financial impact, but it also has a reliability impact as well. Probably more significant is the safety impact. From a substation perspective, grounding wire, which is copper, is a very popular material to be stolen from a substation. When our crews go into a substation, it's not always apparent that this grounding material has been taken, and this puts the men going and women going into that facility at risk because under certain conditions, the substation could become energized because it's not properly grounded and could result in death or injury to the people going in there. So significant safety consideration to our employees going into these facilities. There was also a situation up in Clark County, Washington, in the Public Utility District, where an individual who was intent on stealing copper from a substation went in, came in contact with some portion of the substation that was energized and was killed. So it's not only a matter of significant danger, but it can also result in loss of death or in death as well. So safety is very important. I would just add one other example that we've had in the Utah area. Individuals pulling down overhead wire that's been energized. Although no one was killed in that situation, we did see material like his gloves and clothing that had been burnt. We lost about $10,000 worth of overhead wire, but that did result in a fire, which resulted in about $60,000 worth of damage to structures in that particular area. So, again, it has a compounding impact from place to place. My final comment is that from a Department of Homeland Security perspective, they released a press release back in January of 07 indicating that metal theft is a national security issue affecting the electric grid utility, reliability of the utility. The department made it clear that it's incumbent on states and local authorities to deter metal theft. So I think that's just something to keep in mind, that it's not only a regional concern, it's a national concern, and Department of Homeland Security views this as being a potential threat to the critical infrastructure of the electric utility industry. So with that, I would encourage you to support House Bill 3026. Thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Barron. Any questions? And thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your coming out today. I'd like to call Jeff Stone forward next to help us through the Dash 2 amendments. We get a clear fix on what we have before us in addition to the printed bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask Larry Campbell to come up. And
yes, please.
As a member of the metal recycling industry, that could perhaps answer things pertaining to that. But I'm happy to answer any questions you may have, Mr. Chair.
Well, I guess what it would be helpful, I think, to, at least for me, and I think maybe for other committee members, is that to have an explanation of how what's been changed from the printed bill, based on the summary. Particularly, we see that we had an elevation of criminal punishment from a misdemeanor to a Class C felony, and it appears that that's been removed from the bill.
So Mr. Chairman, Larry Campbell, representing Pacific Corps and also the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, we were working on this from a law enforcement standpoint. Your counsel correctly ascertained that that had been changed to a fine of $1,000 for failure to keep metal records or keeping inaccurately for the first three times. After that, it would be a $5,000 fine. And the reason the coalition developed that particular answer was, one is, it was going to be very costly to apply the other. We also believe that the metal recyclers, the industry, does a very good job. We've been out and actually observed Snitzer and some of those folks, CalBag, and they've done a very good job. One of our real problems was secondhand dealers. And we needed to be able to make sure that they had a penalty that would affect them. And the $1,000 fine seemed to be far more effective for those kind of folks than the fact that we would put them, try to put them in jail for the effort. So that is one of the major changes that we have in the Dash 2 amendments.
What I might do is ask, thank you, Chair McPherson. I've been able to go through the Dash 2 amendment, and I just want to make sure that I'm not missing anything. So my review of it is, we're changing the term from what it was in the original bill about metal recycler or secondhand dealer, and that's becoming scrap metal dealer. That's one big change. Changing the term camera surveillance to video surveillance, and changing the requisite time that you have to hold on to the surveillance from 15 to 30 days.
30 days, right.
Is the second main change. The third one is the one we talked about, where originally it was an existing law, failure to maintain a metal purchase record as a Class B misdemeanor. The original bill would have made it a Class C felony if you had three priors. This bill, it's no longer a misdemeanor. So it changes existing law and just says $1,000 fine, and then after you've had three, $5,000 fine.
Correct.
So let me just break in with that point. So this is one of those unusual cases where we're actually reducing the scope of incarceration, threatened incarceration penalties, and using an economic penalty, which would seem to me to be a more effective driver when you're trying to shape the conduct of businesses.
There's more, though.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll wait.
But there is still a criminal component.
Yes.
And the criminal component is in Section 2 of where it's amending, it's talking about ORS 164.055, and that's the felony, Class C felony, existing law of theft in the first degree. And it adds this section on page 2 of the bill about you're committing the crime of theft in the first degree if the subject of the theft is a non-ferrous metal and it's theft by receiving and the person is the scrap metal dealer.
No, knowingly accepting that material, I think it's...
Knowingly accepting that material. And so there remains a criminal component towards the scrap metal dealer in this bill.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Stanford, I might clarify that we wanted to make sure that we made two distinctions. First of all, we did not want to impugn the integrity of the metal recycling industry and say that they are conducting criminal behavior. We separated scrap metal dealers or metal recyclers to secondhand dealers and made that distinctly different and separate. The second part is, yes, indeed, we wanted to make sure that we got at the folks who are actually not tethered to a legal or moral code, that those folks would be addressed in this bill, that knowingly accept stolen material. I mean, that's a key component. We don't want to criminalize people who have good business practices. And the partners that we've had involved here, I think all do have great business practices. But it's about getting at that point of transaction and making it more difficult on that part.
If I may, I think that it's, and correct me if somebody has a different understanding, but under existing law, it is a crime. We're talking about the crime of theft by receiving. It is the change that this bill makes. But under existing law, 164.055.1A says you commit theft and the total value of the property in a single transaction is $200 or more in a case of theft by receiving. So the point that I'm asking and kind of making is that it's right now theft by receiving of anything over $200 is already a Class C felony. This addition says if it's non-ferrous metal and it's theft by receiving and it's a scrap metal dealer, it is also a Class C felony. Regardless if it's under $200 or not. So does that make sense?
Well, I will defer to your greater legal mind than mine, but I think the key distinction here is that we want to make sure that metal recyclers who knowingly accept stolen material are the ones that will be the most greatly affected by this particular bill. And that's a key distinction for us because we want to make sure that we're not criminalizing the metal recycling industry, and I don't want to make that.
Mr. Stone, I think that the point that counsel's probing here is that although failing to keep a record, which is under existing law, a misdemeanor, would become, with some amount of jail time, would become simply a fine, not an incarceration offense.
Mm-hmm.
It does sound like there's an expansion of the felony of theft by receiving by taking it down, reducing the dollar threshold, if I'm following the discussion
yes.
correctly. So there, and this is, it's relevant because there is a subsequent ways and means on the bill, and so we're trying to get a sense about whether there is a potential fiscal impact which will influence how the bill gets moved forward.
On that point, thank you, Chair McPherson. Council Stanford, in the original bill, because as stated by testimony, that many of these people that are attempting to sell the metal product are methamphetamine users. And so in the original bill in Section 1, subsection C on line 22, it states that the person that's being contacted, that they have a photocopy of the current valid driver's license, passport, or state identification card. Is that included in the dash 2s?
Yes.
Thank you.
It is.
Mr. Chairman and Counsel, I don't think it was our intention to reduce the $200, but it was our intention to identify non-ferrous.
Okay. Any further questions?
Just a couple of the other amendments, just so we have it. One, if there's also an inclusion within the repeat property offender statute within the Dash 2 amendments, and it was in Section 3 originally. And that inclusion is on of the Dash 2 amendments, page 3. It's including, for purposes of the repeat property offender statute, the crime of attempted theft in the first degree, if the attempted theft is as described in this
164.055.
Right. The subject of not, so that's an addition.
Right.
And then there's an additional section that's new, that's entirely new, that wasn't in the original. And this, it kind of was in the original, but in a different way, I suppose, thinking about it more clearly. And that's imposing this same duty upon consignment store, secondhand stores, etc. It's basically the same rules that you have to do if you're a scrap metal dealer. If somebody tries to sell scrap metal to a secondhand store, they have to do the same things. And again, it's not a crime there. It's a violation, same fine amounts. It's $1,000, then $5,000 after you have three priors.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Is there anything else that, as far as you know, that I'm missing on the Dash 2s?
No, and it's important to note that when we met with Legislative Council on this, we met as a coalition as well. I mean, we had representatives from the metal recycling industry and construction to make sure that whatever came through in the Dash 2s had the uniform support of the coalition.
Okay. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not supposed to say council, but perhaps if Mr. Stoner or Mr. Campbell can answer. Is everything that we're addressing in the bill in the Dash 2 dealing with the places that take in the scrap metal, or are we enhancing the penalties for the actual thief?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, no. I don't. We're not enhancing the penalties on the thief, in this bill.
Thank you.
At all. It's all about the person's buying and paying.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I'll look for confirmation from our experts out in front. This is all deal with the conduct of the receiver of the stolen metal and not the conduct of the deliverer of the, of the stolen metal.
Well, respectfully, Mr. Chair, I believe it tackles both of them. It does up the game on those who steal metal.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I believe that you find that there's a presumptive sentence of 19 months of incarceration for metal theft in 3026. And I'm going to have to go back and review that, but I do believe that is a difference.
Where would
repeat
we find
property?
Section 3.
It'd be in the original bill.
The Dash 2.
Section 3.
Page 2 of the Dash 2.
I'm looking at Section 3 and the ORS 137.717. That's existing law.
Not existing law.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah,
the 19 months.
Yeah, and 19 months is existing law.
Yeah, we're talking about. The question went to what are we changing in the bill?
Okay.
And obviously, the conduct of the person stealing metal and delivering it is criminal. But the question is, what does this bill change from existing law? And it sounds like its changes affect only the receiver of the stolen metal.
Those who would knowingly accept stolen material. Yes.
Right. Right. Okay. Any further questions?
I'd just like to comment very briefly. I was dealt in this kind of business when I was working and before I retired, and I found that the scrap metal dealers in Portland were very helpful, and frequently they would call up and say somebody has a truckload of whatever that they thought was suspicious, and that was, you know, so that industry has been very supportive of keeping things legal.
And, Mr. Chair, I'd like to mention that they are victims as well, of metal theft.
Right. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to comment. I know that in my particular North Clackamas Chamber of Commerce. This has been a subject of discussion for quite some time, and especially since my district does have a very significant rural component and a lot of nurseries and other backbone of the state type producers, that this is a very important piece, and I'm very excited and thankful to the whole entire coalition that's come together, not to mention my plumbers, heating and air conditioner businesses and so on. So thank you for your good work on this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, it was interesting to me because there were as many as 45 people involved in the coalition working on this from all different segments of society. And they were all headed the same direction. Basically, what we wanted to do is stop the ability of these people to sell the product they're stealing.
Yeah. Right.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Just how about across the border, the state of Washington, Idaho? Is there similar laws, or is there similar, you know, from the stuff being loading up in mass truckloads and going across, being able to sell it? Where are we there?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Cameron, that was one of the things that concerned our metal recycling companies here, that if we made the law too difficult and too different from Washington, that's exactly what would happen. My understanding is that there is a similar law being worked on in Washington, and they're about through with their legislative session, and it was, as of yesterday, it was in conference committee. Our hope is that the two laws are similar in nature. There are some differences, there's no question about that, but what we're trying to accomplish here, I think, can be accomplished by this, and what the coalition has agreed to is that if this does not do the job, we will be back again next session to correct anything that we find is a deficiency.
Mr. Chair, just one more point. I know there's a bill in the Ag and Natural Resources to allow agricultural nurseries to have temporary housing in their fields and locations to try to help give them another tool to reduce this to, and I would hope that that would get moved. It hasn't as of yet.
If there are no further questions, I'm going to excuse this panel.
Thank you.
And for the benefit of the audience, we're going to be going into recess here in 5 minutes because there's an event commemorating the victims of the Virginia Tech shootings that's going to be happening at 9. So I would like to call let's call Tim Leahy and Paul Ramirez forward, and if we could if you're able to conclude your remarks within the 5 minutes, that would be keep us on schedule.
You first?
Sure.
Okay.
Good morning, Chairman McPherson and members of the committee. My name is Raul Ramirez, for the record. I am the Marion County Sheriff and the President of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I'm here also representing the Chiefs Association as well as the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We're here in support, strong support of House Bill 3026. We support adoption of the Dash 2 amendments that are before the committee for consideration this morning. This effort began last year with the agricultural community to address the issue of metal thefts occurring on farms throughout the state of Oregon. Seeing the onslaught of metal theft occurring at remote locations, and again, Representative Cameron spoke about another bill dealing with housing on agricultural farms, it was real clear that metal thefts throughout the state of Oregon were driven by individuals with meth addiction, and we recognized that the metal was being stolen to support their drug habit. As we launched that effort of working with the agricultural community, nurseries, and the Farm Bureau, et cetera, we recognized the other industries that were also affected, being public utilities, the construction industry, having similar issues. And it wasn't so much just the metal theft, but the actual economic loss to those industries. It's one thing if you have 600 sprinkler heads stolen overnight. The challenge becomes, how do you replace those sprinklers? and the loss of crops, the downtime for the construction industry certainly enhanced the economic loss besides just the property value of those mental thefts. House Bill 3026 is the end result of months of work on the part of a wide range of organizations and groups that are impacted by the growing mental theft problem in Oregon. This bill represents unprecedented cooperation between the construction industry, utilities, agricultural, metal recyclers, and law enforcement that were at the table. As a result of the State Metal Thefts Task Force, I'm pleased to fully lend my support of House Bill 3026. We believe that increasing state penalties for metal theft and increasing regulations at scrap metal recycling facilities is the best way to crack down on metal thefts. The metal theft crisis is now impacting nearly every sector of our state. High market prices for copper and aluminum are enticing thieves to steal metal to sell for scrap. Fueled in part by the building boom in China, demand for copper has pushed its price to historic highs, and aluminum prices are at the highest they've seen in 17 years. Whether the stolen metal is irrigation pipe from Pendleton, copper grounds from the utility station in Bend, sections of narrow gauge rail from the train line on the coast, or gutters from your home, the impact of metal theft is profound.
Sheriff Ramirez, I'm a little concerned about making sure that Mr. Leahy has a chance to get his remarks in before we go into recess. So maybe you could summarize briefly the remainder you have.
In essence, the provisions that have been provided with regards to House Bill 3026 will assist not only law enforcement but protection of all of those victims across the state of Oregon. So we would urge your support for House Bill 3026.
Very good. Thank you very much, Sheriff.
Thank you very much. Chair McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Tim Leahy, and I'm the Director of Marketing with Caldeg Metals, a 97-year-old non-ferrous metal recycler based in Portland, Oregon. I'm here as a member of the task force previously discussed that has spent roughly 6 months discussing ways to make the metal recycling record-keeping law more relevant. I chaired a subcommittee and felt that there were many issues discussed and many compromises made from many different stakeholders to get to this committee hearing today. I would like to acknowledge all the ideas, hard work, and time spent on this issue before today. I'll be brief. We feel that this new bill will help law enforcement better track, catch, and convict criminals engaged in metal theft. It employs our company's best practices statewide to elevate the playing field within our own industry. From video surveillance to full description of the seller and the vehicle, we believe that these new tools for law enforcement and district attorneys will enhance the ability to diminish metal theft. We appreciate the effort it has taken from so many participants to revise this law. Cooperation between police and recyclers is the best way to catch criminals. Not increasing penalties on metal recyclers, because nobody wants to comply with laws more than us and catch and convict thieves more than us, because we are where the metal is, and we are often victims ourselves. Thank you very much. I'll answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Leahy. Any questions? Apparently not. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you very much.
We are now going to go into recess, and we'll be resuming with this hearing as soon as we return. And the next panel, when we do so, will be Greg Miller and Nick Scoville. So we're now in recess.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Greg Miller. I represent the Associated General Contractors, a commercial construction trade association. We represent about 1,100 members statewide, and in conversations with a lot of them, they are all impacted by metal theft. I'll be brief. AGC supports House Bill 3026 with the Dash 2 amendments, and I'd like to introduce Nick Scoville, a member of mine who is here to testify on behalf of the industry and his company.
Mr. Scoville.
Good morning, Chairman McPherson and committee members. My name is Nick Scoville, and I'm president of Triad Mechanical, located at 2133 North Argyle in Portland, Oregon, in the Kenton area, if you're familiar with that. We are a Portland-based company serving clients in the Pacific Northwest and California and Nevada. And we are a mechanical contractor, and we work in heavy industrial as well as in the public sector and the federal sector, and we work on wastewater treatment plants and related facilities, operational facilities. We also specialize in mechanical work and structural steel and rebar and concrete type construction. So I am here today on behalf of Triad Mechanical and Associated General Contractors of Oregon and the Columbia chapter, where I serve on the legislative committee to support House Bill 3026. As a company that deals with steel and metal products on a day-to-day basis, metal theft has impacted our operation. And I could expand on some testimony that was given earlier, but I don't want to do that. One thing I want to point out is that we, like any other contractor, have theft and et cetera on our job sites, and we take preventing measures. But what we've seen since 2005 is we've seen a really an attack on our job sites from individuals who are aggressive and come to our job sites during the day and are taking metal scrap, and our employees are confronting these individuals. And that's a scary, because law enforcement will tell you that these people are not rational. They're irrational, and they're difficult to deal with. So we're finding people who are confronting us just on a daily basis that are trying to take materials off the site. So the provisions contained in House Bill 3026, which seeks to clean up the scrap metal trades, are important for the entire construction industry as we all deal with the growing theft issues. Thank you for your time this morning, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Scoville. Any questions for either of these witnesses? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And our last panel is Rob Bovette and Anna Peterson.
Mr. Chair, representatives, Rob Bovette, on behalf of the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association and the Governor's Meth Task Force, I'll keep it very brief. Ditto to everything you've heard before, and please do pass.
Thank you very much. We love that brevity.
Good morning, Chair McPherson and committee, and thank you for this opportunity. I'm Anna Peterson, and I chair the Governor's Meth Task Force. The Governor's Meth Task Force strongly supports this House bill, and we recommend that you approve it. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Peterson. And thank you to both of you for the long and hard work you've done on the scourge of meth in our state, and I think this is an important dimension of that effort. Any questions? Okay, thank you again. That concludes all the public testimony on House Bill 3026. Members, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3026. And one of the one advantage of the little recess we had was that there was an opportunity to identify some technical issues in the amendment language. So we'll not be taking it to work session today, but we're hoping we can get some minor changes made in the amendments and bring it back. And then what I'm going to do is announce now for the that on the record that we. The work session will be rolled over until Monday, so we don't have to re-notice it. So we expect to have, if we can get the amendments done in time, to go to work session on House Bill 3026 on Monday. I will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2153. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 2153 relates to statute of limitations for certain sex crimes if DNA evidence is available. Generally, felony sex offenses are subject to a 6-year statute of limitations. For first or second degree rape or first or second degree sodomy, limitation is 12 years if DNA evidence is available. If the victim was under 18 years old, the limitations period is the earlier of either 1, the date the victim turns 30, or 2, within 12 years of the date that the crime is reported. In its original format, House Bill 2153 eliminated any limitations period for first and second degree crimes of rape, sodomy, unlawful sexual penetration, and sexual abuse, provided that DNA evidence is available. The only exception is that if it has been more than 6 years from the date of the offense, or if either of the victim under age 18 limitations apply, then the state must commence prosecution within one year of discovering the identity of the defendant through DNA. There's a -1 amendment, which I believe is the one that we are going to be considering, and it limits the scope of the bill, or it alters the bill in a couple of ways. First of all, there's a narrower list of crimes that the bill applies to, There is also then the no statute of limitations has been replaced by 25-year statute of limitations. And then finally, it also changes the time period for bringing a case once DNA evidence is uncovered from 1 year, which is what that was in the original bill, to 2 years.
Thank you, counsel. We have a panel of Heather Hutanen, Scott Healy, and Susan Foreman. Could you come forward? In whatever order you choose.
Good morning, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. My name is Heather Hutanen. I'm the training director for the Oregon Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force, and I'm here to present testimony in support of House Bill 2153. Counsel Stanford already indicated, this bill will amend current, will increase the current statute of limitations from 6 years for adult cases and for all practical purposes 12 years for minor child cases, for certain sex crimes to 25 years. As you know, the first and second degree sex crimes, with the exception of sex abuse, which is limited to sex abuse one in our bill, are all Measure 11 crimes. And so I think that our fundamental belief is that if a suspect is identified, it's certainly in the interest of community and victim safety to hold that individual accountable, whether the crime was committed 5 years or 15 years in the past. And I think that for all practical purposes, we're talking about collecting the DNA evidence of a suspect who has not been identified. And then the prosecutor will have 2 years to commence prosecution once that DNA evidence of the suspect has been linked to a particular individual. So, again, for all practical purposes, we're really talking about stranger crimes most commonly. I think that there could be situations in which you're talking about individuals who are known to each other, but at the time of the crime, for whatever reason, the victim may not have been able to readily identify, for example, that it was her estranged husband because he's wearing a ski mask or something of that nature. But we're, again, talking about cases in which the victim has not identified the suspect and that the DNA have not been connected. I'd also like to note that we have increasing amounts of research on sex offenders that shows that they really tend to be multiple or repeat offenders. Now, certainly that's not in all cases, but again, if we're talking about, for all practical purposes, stranger sex crimes, there definitely is an indication in research, and I would be happy to provide the committee with more information on that. But we're seeing that anywhere from 30 to over 50% of sex offenders are multiple offenders offending throughout their lifetime. I think additionally what I would say is that in recognition of DNA evidence as a viable and reliable form of identifying an individual, we're seeing a national trend in either eliminating or increasing the criminal statute of limitations for felonies, homicides, and sex crimes, felony sex crimes specifically. And we see that also for the purposes of exonerating individuals who have been wrongly convicted or accused. And I think that for all practical purposes, we certainly support the application of DNA evidence as a viable and reliable biological identifier for the purposes of both prosecution and the purposes of exoneration. And with that, I would like to just give Scott Healy an opportunity to speak to the prosecutorial specifics of this legislation. Thank you.
Mr. Healy.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Scott Healy, and I'm a deputy district attorney in Clackamas County, and I have been for about 13 and a half years now. And I prosecuted these types of crimes and other serious crimes, including aggravated murder, death penalty cases, murder, armed robbery, assault, and then serious sex offenses for about 10 years. I'm here testifying on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and it'll probably come as no surprise to you that we're very much in favor of this bill.
obviously these are very serious crimes, and anyone who would commit such a reprehensible crime is really a huge danger to our community. And I'm, you know, probably not saying anything that anyone doesn't agree with. This bill, you know, will help keep our community safer, because these serious offenders would be held accountable for a long period of time, even after they think maybe they had gotten away with their crime. And as Ms. Hutanen just indicated, that offenders such as this, especially the ones that commit the forcible rapes, you know, oftentimes commit multiple rapes, oftentimes are not identified for or ever identified by the victim because they are wearing a mask or they disguise their appearance in some respect. And sometimes the only way we make these cases are through DNA. This bill recognizes, I think, in terms of, you know, sort of legislating with regard to DNA evidence, the advances in scientific technology. And the DNA is now a very proven and exact science. It's very reliable, and my colleague, I'm certain, will talk to that in just a moment in more detail, because I rely on them when I'm proving cases in court to talk about the actual DNA testimony. And just as Ms. Hutanen indicated, you know, if we're going to rely on this to exonerate individuals who have been seriously convicted or convicted of serious offenses, then certainly we can rely on it to convict offenders down the road. One thing I wanted to point out, too, is that the Oregon legislature has actually already identified the serious nature of these crimes and that they are crimes that should have a longer period of limitations in terms of statute of limitations. And is it Mr. Stanford was just reading the some of the statute of limitations statute here, and I brought it along with me. Last legislature in 2005, we expanded the period of time from 24 years to 30 years for victims under the age of 18. They can report. It used to be that if they didn't report by the time they turned 24 years of age, then the statute had run. Now they have until 30 years of age to report, or the statute has run. So we've already identified here, that is, the legislature has identified, that these are serious crimes that should have a longer period of limitations. And so we're hopeful that you'll extend the statute of limitations with these further serious crimes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Healy. Ms. Harmon.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Susan Horman, and I am a DNA analyst with the Oregon State Police Forensic Laboratory. During my more than 18 years with the Oregon State Police, I have worked on the collection and analysis of biological evidence. For 15 of those years, I've worked in the DNA unit as an analyst analyzing DNA and testifying in the court at the trial. The OSP Forensic Division is neutral on this bill. However, I would like to explain a few things about the effect of this bill on the forensic laboratory, as well as the stability of DNA, and a little bit about the analysis. First of all, DNA is a very stable molecule, especially when it's stored under a dry condition. We recommend to the police agencies that they store their evidence with biological material either frozen or at the very least at room temperature, and to maintain it dry. Under these conditions, DNA degrades very slowly. As a matter of fact, we recently performed DNA analysis on a 1970 homicide, and we were able to determine a DNA result from that evidence after that extended period of time. This just reinforces to us that DNA is very stable and that we are able to continue to get good DNA results over an extended period of time. Regarding the degradation of DNA, as it degrades, it breaks down into smaller pieces and just becomes DNA fragments until eventually we are unable to determine what the DNA type is. It does not mutate any way or change in form. An analogy would be that when DNA is fresh, it's like a freshly painted line on the parking lot. Over time, that line starts to fade and break and crack
It does not change direction. It does not become a looping line. It still is a line. DNA is still the same DNA. It just degrades. It does not mutate into somebody else's DNA as it degrades. In addition, part of my job at the Oregon State Police DNA unit is to analyze evidence from unsolved or no suspect cases. In these cases, we are targeting or attempting to find a DNA profile that can then be entered into the Oregon State Police database and the national database, where it then would be searched against offender profiles and other unsolved cases from all 50 states. Once this profile is entered, it continues to be searched on a weekly basis against these two databases. Currently, the Oregon State Police database has 76,000 DNA profiles in there. The national database has 4.3 million profiles that we are comparing. And finally, this bill has no fiscal impact on the forensic laboratory, because once that profile is entered into the database, no additional analysis is done. And that's all I have, if you have any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Horman. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Ms. Harmon?
Ms. Horman.
Ms. Horman. 76,000 in the Oregon State Police, 4.3 million in the federal. What triggers getting in that database?
The criteria is that the profile cannot be from a victim. It cannot be from a consensual person, a husband or something like that. It has to be from an unidentified individual on a piece of evidence that is, there is no reason for them to be there. So if it's from the suspect's own house, we would not enter that profile because there is a reason, you know, a good reason why he would be there. However, if we determine a DNA type from, say, a sperm fraction on the victim's vaginal swabs, then there's no reason for that to be there, and that would be the type of profile that would be entered.
A follow-up, if I may.
Go ahead.
So I was under the impression that anybody convicted of a felony in the state of Oregon is in that database, or we try to get them in that database. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative Cameron, excuse me. I understood your question to mean what type of evidentiary profiles. The type of profiles in total that are in the database are of many different categories. The one category I spoke of is what we call the forensic evidence category. We also have in the database categories of convicted offender profiles. So people who are convicted of felonies, they are required to submit a sample to be entered into the database as well. And the other categories are missing persons, relatives of missing persons, unidentified remains, but those categories are much smaller.
If I may, a couple of, and I've heard testimony on a couple of areas that I think it's 1 in 90 of those that are being entered into there that are convicted felons, 1 in 90 we find another crime or we're able to solve another crime. And if that's the case, and we extend the statute of limitations here, is there any projections as to it'll go from 1 to 90 to 2 and 90? Do we have any idea? In other words, if today we hit a DNA that somebody is already in prison, we did a DNA to solve a case, but they'd already passed the statute of limitations, we wouldn't consider that a case that we'd solved. Is that accurate?
Those are not going to change our current stats. We report to the DA's office and the police agency currently, even if the statute has passed. It's not our responsibility or burden to determine exactly if that statute is passed, because sometimes there are some exceptions to that. So that number will not change.
And one last, what is the current backlog of DNA that has not been processed in the federal, those that have been convicted of felonies?
If I understand your question correctly, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, are you speaking to the number of convicted offender samples that are collected or the number of evidence samples that we have?
Convicted offenders that the backlog is?
I believe that that's about 20,000, between 20 and 30,000 samples that still have been collected and not analyzed and entered into the database.
Thank you.
Representative Bonamici, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do. To Ms. Horman, thank you for being here. I find this fascinating, but I don't know very much about it. So I want to ask a question about, obviously, at some point in time, the DNA degrades, but you said there was a case that you're working on from 1970, and that was reliable. So I guess I want to know, with what percent of certainty can you say that the 25-year limit means that the DNA will be reliable?
I think at this point in time, Mr. Chair, Representative, that we are aware, I mean, the 1970 case was remarkable because they were working under 1970 rules where they didn't know that DNA was going to come. You know, currently with this bill, 25 years, they know that DNA exists, and we know how to store it and preserve it. So we're even ahead of the game in the sense that we are able to collect that DNA plus and put it into the database. So 25 years is not necessarily that we're going to need to go back and even analyze it because it's in the database, but if we did need to analyze it, I think that we're more aware of how to preserve it than we were 30 years ago.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
So in your professional opinion, because obviously you have a lot of expertise in this area, would DNA that is 25 years older or less be reliable?
Yes, it's always reliable. It's just that it may not exist anymore if it hasn't been stored correctly, or that what it was deposited on caused it to degrade quicker than the 25 years. It's always going to be reliable.
Thank you. I understand. One more follow-up, please.
You may.
Is there a reason then why your department is neutral on this bill instead of supportive?
I was given direction that, if you will, I'm new to this, okay. And that if we are not proposing the bill ourselves, that typically the Oregon State Police Forensic Lab gives a neutral position.
Understood. Thank you.
Representative Park.
Thank you. Mr. Herman. You have 20,000 samples. How much does it cost to process those? I heard, I can't remember, was it $3,000 to process a sample or
$35?
$5.
Yeah. Okay. It's currently, for those convicted offender samples, the processing is about $35.
Okay, great. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Harmon, is there a contractor that you could contract some of that work out to that could do that to help you with your backlog?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wisnett, yes, we are contracting those out, and that's being paid for through the National Institute of Justice grant that we have. It's contracted to a Dakota, I think it's North Dakota Laboratory, Identity Genetics, is currently doing those samples.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what percent do you do in-house versus out?
We completely outsource all the samples. If they are unable to get a DNA profile because it's low, then we will end up doing it in-house.
Thank you.
Okay. If there are no further questions, then I'll excuse this panel, and we'll hear from Andrea Meyer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. And at this time, the ACLU is opposed to House Bill 2153. And I want to explain why, in light of the fact that you will shortly, hopefully in May, when you start hearing Senate bills, you will take up a bill that has to do with DNA evidence to establish innocence. And I will link that about what our concerns are with the limitation of that law as to our concerns with it here. As background for policy issues for my organization, most crimes have a six-year statute of limitations from the time the crime was committed. And current law provides exceptions, which are continually broadened and expanded in terms of the length of time. And last session was, the, I believe, the 10th time in about 10 years, expanding the law in Section 1, Subsection 2, the 30 years and the 12 years, which had previously been 24 to 6. And we just have concerns that we do this incremental expansion and these narrow exceptions become much broader ones. And in general, you know, as part of the criminal justice system, it established the statute of limitations because at the same time that it allows the victim to confront the accuser, it allows the accuser to mount a defense, to call witnesses. And the more time that expires between the crime and the accuser being tried, the more difficult it can be for our system to work. So we are concerned about the incremental expansions that appear appealing each session in their small, narrow area, but continually expand it a lot. Also, with the change in the law last session, it allows DNA to be used in this situation even if the person who was subject to the crime didn't report the crime at the time, and the DNA wasn't collected by the police at the time. And I spoke briefly to Heather, so I want to make sure I have this right, but it could be a situation under the current law where if I'm a, depending on the timelines and exceptions, I am assaulted, I say collect the bed sheet, I put it in a bag, I don't report the crime, 15 years later I turn it over to law enforcement and I report the crime if I was a victim under a certain age. And so there is currently in our process not just an extension of time upon the person reporting the crime, but an extension even if the person didn't report the crime and turn over the evidence to law enforcement. Now, certainly if they turn over the evidence having retained it in a bag for 10 years, it may have degraded. But it does raise this concern with us in linking and expanding the extensions of time with the link between the victim and the accusations. Now, there also, I should note that I certainly think the Dash 1 amendments narrow the bill, and it's kind of a good example of where I think we'll be back in 2, 4, 6, or 8 years. I believe that this law, as if you establish it, they'll be coming back for expansions similar to the original draft of the bill. The one sort of, I would say, exception to the our inclination to prefer the amendments over the original bill is page 3, lines 7 through 10, which, as it reads right now, once a prosecution for a felony listed, if it would otherwise be barred, it may be commenced within 1 year of the DNA-based identification of the defendant. So they now, through the DNA, identify John Smith as the defendant. It's allowing, instead of 1 year, it would give 2 years. You know, we would urge you to make that as narrow as possible. Again, in our criminal justice system, the defendant needs to have the opportunity to mount a defense. And DNA can certainly incriminate someone, but in a certain situations, it may be unclear if they were indeed the actual perpetrator of the crime. It's very narrow in its opportunities. Now I want to raise the bigger policy concerns of, in addition, why we really oppose this. DNA evidence, biological evidence retained by the state, is only as good if it's retained. And the large concern we have when we talk about our DNA innocence law, which allows someone who's been convicted of a crime and goes forward with a pretty restricted motion process to assert that there is biological evidence that now could be tested, which otherwise either wasn't tested or the technology didn't allow it to be tested to establish their innocence. Here's one of the major problems for us with that, or the limitations. It requires the biological evidence to have been retained. And for as long as I've been working on that law for the last 6 years, because it's come back with sunsets and hope we're removing it this year, as long as I've been working on that, I've asked, what are the policies of the 36 counties, the Oregon State Police, the courts, when cases are adjudicated and biological evidence, as well as the other evidence, may go back to the originating jurisdiction, or more importantly, where does it go? What is, there are no laws requiring retention and preservation. So while we have a DNA innocence law on the books, it's only as good if there's evidence retained, and I'm fearful that it isn't. The last point I simply want to make is to point out why this is a global issue for us. ORS 181085, the statute that starts with authority over blood and buccal samples and analysis, rules, and disclosure, states in part, the Department of State Police is authorized to maintain, store blood and buccal samples, analyze such samples, maintain criminal identification databases, and utilize such samples to create statistical population frequency databases, provide that genetic profiles or other information in a population frequency database shall not be identified with specific individuals. In other words, our concern here is our laws are extremely outdated. DNA information is very powerful, not just about the individual, but the familial links and private, very personal medical and other information. And as our government expands to take DNA and store it, we really need to revisit the safeguards from research and other purposes. When we talk about DNA evidence, people say, oh, well, you can separate it from the person, and it's anonymous. And I need to make one last point, which is that arguably DNA is, in light of this bill, you can see, never anonymous. If I have a DNA sample that's unmarked, and it's you over here and it's your sample, if I take your DNA and I've got the sample, I can link it. It's never anonymous. It may be decoded. It may be marked as anonymous, but it truly never can become anonymous if you have the person you can link it back to. So there's large global issues for us that bring us to the point of opposing this bill. If you do move it forward, I would urge you to go back to the 1 year. I wanted to point one last thing that when the Oregon State Police noted that in response to Representative Cameron's question, which was an interesting question, I mean, what is currently in the criminal database, that they noted that missing persons, DNA is in there. There's a missing persons bill. I don't know if it will make it over, but one of the things that they were willing to put in was the requirement that if a missing person's DNA is put into this criminal database and they're either located and alive or deceased, that they get notice and the opportunity to have it removed from the criminal database. So, you know, it's these safeguards as we start moving in these different areas that we really need a global conversation about the power of DNA and how to use it both to exonerate and to convict folks. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. What strikes me about your presentation is that, and it really, you echoed it in your last comment, that DNA evidence can do one of two things. It can either convict or exonerate. So that from the perspective of the ACLU, I think it's a powerful force going either way. In either case, though, there has to be an appropriate chain of custody. I mean, I'm imagining that it's always going to come up because there is a sample taken at the crime scene, and that is preserved, and then the DNA is then compared to, you know, sometime later, maybe perhaps many years later, to the DNA currently of the accused, or maybe convicted in the case of exoneration, and the historical sample. So it does seem to me that either way, that sample needs to be preserved promptly. And that would be true for the exoneration cases as well as the deferred prosecution cases like we have here before us. Does the ACLU stand on the same position with respect to the preservation, you know, the when the sample has to be collected and how it's preserved, regardless of which way it's being used?
Chair McPherson, that is almost precisely our point. I think the Oregon State Police does take the steps necessary when they have evidence collected to go through using the most advanced technology now to preserve it. Mm-hmm. And it's probably preserved forever or until there's a conviction. So our concern is once there's a conviction
and the person is now incarcerated, or in the case of murder or other crime, and released. And I note for the record that both murder and rape crimes, persons are still, quote, punished after they're released, you know, permanent, you know, sex offender registration or murder, there's a continual thing. So the need for proving innocence even after they're incarcerated may be relevant. So what happens, what our concern is, there doesn't appear to be any law on the books, and we don't know even what the policies are for what happens after the conviction and the adjudication. And we need to make, we need to do that. We need to have consistent laws that even, because sometimes biological evidence is retained right now, but it may not be testable because our science is advancing. So it's not just what we could test, the DNA evidence we could test, but also retaining the biological evidence that right now isn't testable, but is biological and in the future could be. And that's where often people who have been incarcerated, and I want to give an example, if I may, because it's sort of, you said you either convicts you or exonerates you. There's a gray area. This is a really fascinating area. I want to give you one quick scenario. A rape situation, and you've got someone who's been convicted of it. And the victim says there were two rapists. And they got DNA from one rapist. But it wasn't testable at the time. They're both convicted. One of the defendants says, that wasn't me, I'm innocent. Now you can test the DNA. They test the DNA. Sure enough, it's not that defendant. Well, the state is going to argue, we're sorry. There were two defendants. This does not exonerate you of the crime. Where it would is if there was just one defendant. See, so it's very limited. The power of DNA can be extremely powerful. But that person could be innocent or may be guilty. But the lack of DNA evidence doesn't help them. I just use that as an example to understand how where DNA evidence could be exculpatory, there'll be a very tight standard before someone's released based on it.
Representative Bonamici.
Well, I just had a quick question, and you know, we hear these stories about somebody who's exonerated because of DNA. So then what happens to the DNA? Is it then taken out of the criminal database?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, in short, I don't know, but I do not believe there's any requirement. I doubt the person gets notice. I don't know that we've had situations in Oregon, but there were situations in other states where people were requested for a sample. Particularly, they were in a state, the issue was targeting African Americans, and they were all asked to give a sample or you'd get a court order. This individual complied. His sample did not match. He asked for it to be removed, to be returned to him and not be entered in a database, and this state refused, and he had to go to court and get an order. So it is an issue, and silence is a problem in our law, and we need to give our government clear instructions that in Oregon, that shouldn't happen.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay, Ms. Meyer, and committee, before we close the public hearing, I want to have a little discussion here to get a sense about where we ought to be going with this bill. We're getting down to short time. The one concern that was raised is that the collection of sample under this bill doesn't have to be collected and preserved in law enforcement or the forensics lab system promptly after the offense. It could be, the example used, I think, is a sheet or something that's preserved by the victim for maybe years hence and then turned over, although it seems a little unlikely that would happen. But that's why I raised the question about whether it would be the same kind of timing and custody preservation issues that would apply in the, whether it's exoneration or whether it's prosecution.
I'd like Ms. Horman's opinion on whether that would affect the reliability, depending on where.
Well, it would be, I mean, excuse me, if I could, it would be, I mean, you could argue if you're the defense attorney, you could certainly argue about that, whether it's valid or not, and that would be, you know, it would be an issue to be decided by a jury or judge. But chain of command, I mean, if you don't have chain of custody, rather chain of command, chain of custody, you're in bad shape going to trial with that. So, I mean, I don't see that that's a problem. I don't mind you asking him, of course. But, if I bring in a sheet and say I had that 10 years, I mean, that, you know, if you're the defense attorney, you're going to certainly have a good argument about that. And, I mean, it's kind of like same thing like fingerprints. You may have fingerprints. My fingerprints may be in a house, but I may have some reason for them to be there other than have been that particular crime. And, you know, that's what the trial's all about. I mean, you go in there and show that, well, I'd been there at a party one time, and so my fingerprints were there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know.
Well, I'd say, as a general matter, I think that statutes of limitations are appropriate because,
right,
you know, over long periods of time, memories fade, and you get less reliable prosecutions.
Absolutely.
So this is carving out an exception where there's DNA evidence, and I'm comfortable doing that if we have a careful chain of custody.
Right.
So that we can say, yeah, that's the sample that was taken at the time and preserved in an appropriate chain of custody, so that you then I would be comfortable extending the statute of limitations. But it's only I think with that kind of care, and so I'm a little concerned about that issue. But I'm also was raising this question with our last witness about whether it would go both ways, because it seems to me somebody who wants to be exonerated should probably be held to the same standard.
Right, if it's available. But, I mean, if somebody else turns it in, I mean, that would certainly, I would think, would it not open the door to defense? I mean, you would certainly challenge that, and I would think you'd have, I mean, I suppose anything can happen, but I just don't see that circumstance. If somebody did, I mean, why wasn't it turned in sooner? You have all those reasons to question it.
Is Mr. Healy still here? He's got more prosecutorial experience than I do, but in my 2+ years, absolutely. What you would have happen is that a defense attorney would file a motion to exclude the evidence pre-trial, and the judge would make the determination pre-trial about whether the state can show an adequate chain of custody or establish a proper foundation for the evidence that it wants to introduce. There would be witnesses on both sides. The judge would hear that, and based on existing case law, would make the determination whether there is an adequate chain of custody for this evidence or not.
So I guess the issue isn't the reliability of the DNA. It's more of the chain of custody issue.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, you have to show that it came from you.
Right, and because the question is, the policy choice is, should we be requiring a chain of custody as a condition for extending the statute of limitations? Or should we not require specific chain of custody, that is, collection at the time and preservation, and allow those, the potential for a prosecution, with then let the people put on their case and have it rebutted? President Cameron.
Mr. Chair, I understand your point there, but I think from what counsel just said, that chain of custody is going to be determined in the court, just like any other piece of evidence in the court. Is this evidence admissible based on expert testimony and witnesses, of which probably we have one here that may be even a part of that process? I'm not sure we want to. I mean, obviously, we need to make sure that people are treated fairly in the courts, and I think your point of working both ways is really important, and I think that's left up to the judge and the defense attorney and those people that are moving forward to determine whether that is admissible in the court of law. And I think DNA has been working fine. I know we heard about, we'd like to put some sidebars around it, but I'm sure that if there weren't pretty solid sidebars around it right now, it wouldn't be used as evidence in our courts.
Mr. Chair, I've seen cases be lost when somebody picked it up at the scene and then gave it to another officer, and then it went to the property room, and there's an officer in the middle there, went to two, and they say, well, geez, I think Barker had it known, you know, maybe it was Wisnan, or boom, you're gone, your evidence is excluded. So it's...
Well, the committee, the reason I'm holding this discussion in hearing is that we can either take it to work session and move the bill today, or if we thought there were amendments that could be that would make it more acceptable to the committee, were it necessary to gain support, then we could not open a work session and roll that over until we have an amendment back. So that's where their choice is.
I'd support it as is, and if they need an amendment on the other side, because again, we're getting so late in the. Right.
I'd be interested in knowing whether it would be a simple amendment to put in this provision about somehow or another the reliability of the
well, that's in the law. I mean, I can't go to court. I mean, if I don't have a reliable chain of custody, I'm out. That evidence is gone.
Yeah, no, I think
if it's useful, the whole process would be, as we've talked about previously, a preliminary determination by the judge based on what witnesses would say. Good chain of custody, state would say. Bad chain of custody, defense would say. Judge would make that preliminary determination. It's in or it's excluded altogether. And even if there was a case where maybe it's kind of a close call and the judge decides I'm going to allow it, the defense attorney would then still, once the trial starts, Miss Christian I know would do this, just attack in trial before the jury. The state didn't have this evidence. It was sitting in your room. This is suspicious, and that's a huge red flag that would go up. But, that doesn't answer the question of whether we want to put these bars up. But my point is just there are multiple ways. That's how it would play out in the process.
I understand.
Your name's being invoked, Ms. Christian. We are in public hearing, so if you'd really like to offer comments,
yeah.
Please.
She's my attorney. She better attack.
She would.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ann Christian, and I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And you may wonder why I haven't testified prior to this time. It's because during significant negotiations, we took the position, OCDLA, that we would be neutral on the bill. So I want that to be clear. But with regard to the question of statute of limitations and the purpose of them, I think we all agree that there ought to be a statute of limitations. And what a statute of limitations does is prevent an individual from being charged. So if there's a statute of limitations of 10 years, and the person has not been charged for whatever reason, good or bad, that person can't be charged. And so when we start talking about the defense attorney would raise chain of custody and all of these other issues, I just want to make the point that a statute of limitations means that there wouldn't even be a defense attorney because the person can't be charged outside of those statute of limitations. And that's important for people, I mean, all of us, to know that at some point in time there will be no charges whether we're innocent, I mean, if we're innocent. So I wanted to make that distinction because if you start talking about, well, the defense attorney will bring that up, that means an individual has at least been charged with the offense and has to get counsel and the stigma and everything else that occurs, especially on sex offenses.
But what would happen, Ms. Christian, I think, is that if it was many years later, beyond the otherwise applicable statute of limitations, then the prosecutor would have to decide, do I have DNA evidence that I can base an indictment now,
correct,
charge this person for an offense because beyond what would otherwise be the applicable statute. But if they have what they think is valid DNA evidence, they would be able to do so. And the question, I think the policy choice that I was framing is, should we be limiting that so that it's a by putting what the chain of custody kind of requirements that would otherwise be argued to the court in the trial into the statute of limitations exception that extends the statute to allow that charging to go on.
And Mr. Chair, there were various versions of that we discussed with Heather with regard to this bill that did have that type of provision. So things... The language, I believe, has been drafted.
I see.
I would like to move it out today. I have difficulty. I mean,
well, we're getting down to the point, yeah. Committee, where things either are going to happen or not.
Yeah, that's fine.
This it does have a subsequent ways and means on it. As well as it's got other portals it's going to have to get through, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would be interested in moving it out today as well. I think that just to kind of reframe the discussion. We're talking about extending the statute of limitations in certain sex crimes where DNA has been collected. So yeah. I think in the context of sex crimes, big problem, social problem, we need to have yet another mechanism to try to deal with that. I would be interested in moving this.
DNA is either
Okay. It's a useful discussion. I'm going to therefore close the public hearing on House Bill 2153 and open a work session on House Bill 2153.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2153 to the floor with the new pass. Move the dash ones into 20.
Representative Barker moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 2153. Is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'll give it a courtesy vote, but I still want to think some more about possible amendments and may change my mind or talk to somebody on the Senate side.
And I would encourage anybody who's uncomfortable to feel free to vote no, just to signal that there are issues about this bill that maybe need bear more further scrutiny. Any further discussion? If not, is there any objection to the dash one amendments? And they're in the bill.
And Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2153 to Ways and Means.
Yes.
Okay, let the due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2153 as amended for the due pass recommendation to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion of the motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Barker. Aye.
Representative
Hammond.
Aye.
Representative
Forrest.
Aye.
Representative
Comp.
Aye.
Representative
Krieger. Excused.
Representative Reed.
Excused.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wizard.
Excused.
Chairman Person.
Aye. House Bill 2153 is amended, moves from the committee with a due pass recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2153. And as you can see, committee, we're only making slow progress through our agenda, but I hope it will speed up at this point. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2799. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 2799 relates to district attorneys, deputy district attorneys in the private practice of law. ORS 8.726 prohibits any district attorney or deputy district attorney who makes more than $18,000 a year from engaging in the private practice of law, meaning they can supplement their income by taking different cases on the side besides their prosecution cases. In present law, there is a specific exception in subsection 2 for the district attorneys of Sherman, Wallawa, and Wheeler counties. Presently, the district attorneys from Gilliam, Sherman, and Wheeler counties are part-time only, is my understanding. House Bill 2799 removes the exception for these district attorneys, and it would prevent them from supplementing their respective incomes through additional legal work. I will have testimony on this, but my understanding is that's kind of a farce. They cannot get additional work because they're conflicted out of most things because they do prosecution, so they can't take criminal defense work, so it's an exception that really doesn't mean anything. But I'll let Mr. Neely or whoever explain that more.
Very good. Mr. Neely, I think that you're the only person signed up on this bill, although I can't find the sign-up sheet here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'd be pretty surprised if I wasn't the only person testifying on this bill. I think there's only four people in the state who really care about this issue. For the record, Kevin Neely, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Mr. Chair, I thank you for giving House Bill 2799 a hearing. I was in front of this committee a couple days ago talking about a separate bill that had ramifications on our budget proceedings. House Bill 2799 is a similar bill that implements one of the policy sides of the Oregon District Attorney's budget. Right now, as Council Stanford indicated, there are three part-time district attorneys. And I think that Council Stanford used the correct term when he said that the notion that there are any part-time district attorneys is a bit of a farce. Right now, these individuals are paid as part-time, but for the most part, they're working full-time. And in the counties of Sherman, Wheeler, and Gilliam, there really is no opportunity for part-time work for any of these district attorneys. They're engaged in the practice of public law. They're engaged in prosecution. In most of these communities, the population is under 1,500. So if they've been in office for 8 or 9 years, usually they've prosecuted someone in almost every family or a relation. It's remarkable, really. And that's why you find, in fact, that the tenure of the district attorney in these districts is not as long as the tenure that you see around the state. And I think that underscores, I bring that up for not just because it's an interesting fact, but also because it has bearing on the importance of this bill. There has been it's been incredibly difficult to find and retain high-quality district attorneys in these districts. We're fortunate right now. We have a couple of district attorneys that are longstanding. We have one that's brand new, one that's been in office. Well, one's been there for 15, one for about 6 years, and one for under a year. And I can tell you that the governor has generally needed to appoint these positions because someone leaves midterm for two reasons. One, they don't get enough money. And two, they literally get pushed out by the families of the people that they've prosecuted in these small communities. What this bill will do is it will remove the stigma that this is a part-time position. Hopefully we can then turn to the Ways and Means Committee, seek some additional resources so that we can pay these folks for the full-time work they're already engaged in, and help and ensure that we have a easier time recruiting and retaining district attorneys in Sherman, Wheeler, and Gilliam counties. Again, this is a fairly straightforward bill. It only affects four district attorneys. But for practical purposes, it only affects three because Wallawa, I think, is an oversight in the law already because the Wallawa district attorney is already a full-time attorney and doesn't practice any other law. And I can tell you that the three district attorneys affected by this are well aware of this bill. They are not practicing law outside. No attorney has practiced law in one of these counties for at least a decade outside of the work they do as prosecutor. With that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions, and I'd urge the committee to move this bill out onto the floor.
Mr. Neely, if I'm remembering my Oregon geography correctly, Sherman, Gilliam, and Wheeler counties, three of the four, are adjacent to each other. They're all kind of in a cluster in sort of the north-central part of the state. So that it would, there's just not, one wonders then, why isn't there one full-time DA for all three counties? Why don't we consolidate that function?
Mr. Chair, I don't think that's a bad question, and I can tell you that that has been something that that both the governor's office and Ways and Means have talked to the District Attorneys Association about. Frankly, I suspect the reason for that is, one, historical. There's always been 36 district attorneys. They've always been independently elected by the county. And I think that the second reason for that is a statutory reason. We've looked at the Constitution to see if, in fact, you need a constitutional change to, in effect, consolidate these districts. And at least an initial blush review is that that is not the case. Again, that's mostly an issue of cost savings. As I said, for practical reasons right now, I don't think you'd find any of these district attorneys is working part-time. I suspect that you'll find that in most cases they're working at least 40 hours a week, and in many instances they're working far more than 40 hours a week just to execute the responsibilities of the district attorney's position in those counties. The problem is they're only paid for part-time work. So I think if you look at the pay, it would speak to the need to consolidate. But if you look at the workload, it would speak to the need to just pay these folks for what they really are, and that's full-time district attorneys.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Neely for being here. I'm just a couple questions. First one is the deputy district attorneys. Is there any part-time deputy district attorneys? And the second question is, I'm struggling with the $18,000 amount to exempt these people, and if we're trying to get them to be full-time people, shouldn't that be raised to a higher amount?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I think what I can tell you, one, let me answer your first question about deputies. There are part-time deputy district attorneys around the state. I don't think they're affected by, I've never known them to be affected by this law. I don't know of any part-time, I think in most offices the deputies aren't doing outside work. Now, again, I don't know that for sure. I'll check on that and get back to you. As for the amount here, I frankly don't know why that amount is in there. I can tell you that it's the District Attorneys Association's preference that DAs are DAs and they're not practicing law other than being the district attorney or a deputy district attorney. That's how it is for most public lawyers. That's how it ought to be for district attorneys.
And by reading the bill, it's the $18,000 figure would be removed. Yeah. I think it's just, it strikes me as something historical because it's so out of touch with current compensation rates.
He makes that much of it before lunch.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I understand it's coming out, but I'm struggling with if I was a member of one of these small counties that doesn't have a lot of money, or I mean, we're supposed to pay them, I guess, from the Ways and Means. It's the district attorneys are actually paid from the state general fund is the way I understand that to be. So my concern, and I obviously being on Ways and Means, if we pull any kind of a limit out there, that what if this thing doesn't get funded? We're still allowing these small counties. Is this going to cause a bigger problem for small counties to recruit somebody who's going to be their DA?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, obviously that's something that we considered. And what I can tell you is in having a discussion with the co-chairs, it was their strong recommendation that we go ahead and fix this problem to show how committed we are to making these people full-time employees.
Right.
And hence, I am in front of you today. But I think in reality, these are not part-time positions anymore. They're full-time positions, there's always going to be a challenge recruiting for those positions because of the geographic location, because right now they're paid lower. We'll have a discussion with you on Thursday of next week about why we think these positions ought to be either moved up into the next tier. This would make only two tiers of pay for DAs, or whether or not you want to keep it at the lower tier, say they're full-time, and struggle with recruitment in the future, continue to struggle with recruitment.
Thank you.
Representative Cobb.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. I would suggest if I was on the Ways and Means Committee, I'd want a little bit more clarified detail. I'd want to know how many hours they are working. You're only talking about four people, talking about four phone calls, and getting some information that's a little more factual about how many hours they're working.
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, I appreciate that, and I apologize. I only included two of the attachments that District Attorney Weatherford provided for me in my written testimony. I can tell you that I have an extensive spreadsheet that lists exactly the number of misdemeanors, felonies, and violations that occur in each of these counties and compares it with the other district attorneys that are full-time pay. And at the bottom end, I mean, the truth is that these three district attorneys are indeed at the bottom end in terms of the number, but there are full-time district attorneys that have comparable caseloads.
But just to follow up, Chair, my comment would be to you, as somebody that's lived in a small community, what might be a minor driving infraction in Salem, in my old hometown, Mount Angel, might take 3 hours to discuss. So, I mean, the equivalent crime probably has a lot of dissection in certain parts of the state rather than others. So,
which may be the reason for it. You notice that the last paragraph in the Gilliam County statement that there have been several successful recalls.
Exactly. That's my point.
Representative Kopp, it sounds like you spent some time in Sherman County.
No, just in rural parts of Marion.
Any further questions for Mr. Neely? Then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2799 and open a work session on House Bill 2799.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2799 to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2799 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair, that this is one of the true need to read between the lines bills, and whatever we can do to help in this area, it seems like if this is necessary, go ahead and do it. But it seems like a roundabout way to get to where they need to be.
Concur on all points. Any further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici, aye. Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cox.
Aye.
Representative Singer, excuse. Representative Reed, excuse. Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Lucas.
Aye.
Chair Chair McPherson.
Aye. House Bill 2799 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And I think we need a carrier for this because, as I say, it's reading between the lines. Needs explanation.
Sure.
Representative Barker, thank you for taking that on. I will close the work session on House Bill 2799 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3443. Representative Wisnik. Or actually, Council, why don't you introduce the bill while Representative Wisnik's witness get off.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 3443 creates a Class A misdemeanor of disruption at funeral-related ceremonies held at cemeteries or similar places. House Bill 3443 creates a new Class A misdemeanor for persons who disrupt certain funerals and related occasions. More specifically, the offense consists of the following elements. One, intentionally make or assist in making noise or a diversion. Two, that tends to disrupt or disturb the peace. Three, at a funeral, memorial, wake, burial, etc. Four, held at a cemetery or similar location. Five, the noise disruption is not part of the funeral. And then any one of the following. 6A, at any time beginning 1 hour before the ceremony and ending 1 hour after the ceremony. 6B, inside the cemetery or a similar location or within 300 feet of the property line. Or 6C, within 150 feet of the property line and a road leading to the site. Or 6D, that impedes access into or egress from the cemetery. The term noise or diversion is defined specifically, and it generally refers to conduct including but not limited to picketing, speeches, displays of signs, banners, distribution of handbills. This bill would not take effect until and unless House Joint Resolution 52 is approved by the people.
Representative Wisnik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and honorable committee members. I know we've been here a long time, and I appreciate you hearing this bill. The bill is described by our counsel, Mr. Stanford, is similar to the 109th Congress passed Public Law 109228. The federal law states that each state should enact legislation to restrict demonstrations near any military funeral. However, as you've seen in this bill summary, the bill takes effect only if the House Joint Resolution 52 is approved by the people at a special election. When I drafted the bill 3443, legislative counsel was concerned about the federal law and whether it will be held as constitutional due to freedom of speech. Since then, there has been a federal judge in Columbus, Ohio, last week, who upheld significant portions of a state law that limits when and where people may protest. Mr. Chair and committee members, I wish that I didn't think this bill was necessary, and I hope we never have to enforce it. In the VA committee hearing of House Joint Resolution 52, there was supportive testimony, but Mr. Chair, I'm sure I could have arranged testimony from law enforcement and family members who have suffered by the demonstrations or potential demonstrations, which while our Oregon families were honoring their loved ones, like the Tucker family from Madras or the Newman family from Bend. Thus, I appreciate the chair hearing this bill, and maybe we should pass it based upon the ruling in Ohio. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wisnik. Representative Barker.
I was thinking, there was a funeral one time, military funeral, where a veteran was going to be buried, and the people with him were of different political persuasion, but it was his deal. And that was prohibited. I mean, they told people they couldn't come in the cemetery and so on. I mean, I don't know how that would work if it was a pro. And this case was a little unusual. It was the, if I can remember his name, head of the American Nazi Party when he was killed. And they wanted to, his people wanted to take him in there and bury him, and they had the 82nd Airborne stop him. But, I mean, so what if it's a pro-demonstration? I mean, this is, you can't have a demonstration. What if I want to say, God bless America? I mean,
we could. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Barker. He always brings up important questions. I would think that we could amend the bill to say that the families desire of who they want in there. But as I said, I hope it hurts me that we have to even think about having a bill to do this. But I think what I witnessed in my area of the state, the demonstration that happened at the Tucker family funeral, where this young man had been tortured terribly by the terrorist in Iraq, and his family had to suffer that and then turn around and suffer the demonstration by a group that was terrible. It just wasn't necessary.
Okay. And Representative Wisner, I think I've understood that House Joint Resolution 52 is not moving forward. Is that your understanding as well?
Yes, sir.
So under the terms of the bill as drafted, it would, even if this were to pass through and get be signed by the governor, by pass both chambers and signed by the governor, it couldn't take effect because that resolution is not moving forward.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And again, I think because of what's happened in the legal courts, maybe we can bring it back next session, and it definitely should be passed because, as I said, the federal law says that you will, and that states should enact their own. And we were concerned about the legal credibility of the statute up on the federal level, but it looks like that's turning out to be good. So I'll leave that up to the chair. I think that, as I said, the federal law says we should pass one, whether we wait till next session or we do it this session, we should do it, because I hope we never have to use the law.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Wisnett, for bringing this issue up for discussion. I have very serious concerns about this for First Amendment reasons, and I think that if somebody was truly disruptive, that there would be existing disturbance of the peace or other laws that would address that issue. But one of the questions I have about the way this is drafted is you're talking about military funeral. This applies to any funeral. And so I don't know if that's what you intended. But this would be very wide ranging, and it doesn't even apply to, it applies to just holding a sign, which I would really have trouble supporting it. I think it would be a serious infringement on First Amendment grounds. I haven't read the case that you're talking about from Ohio, and I don't know if that's limited to military funerals, but I just wanted to express my concern. Not that I don't appreciate the hardship that people are suffering at these, when it happens. But that's what our First Amendment provides, is the right to free speech. And the best way to counter speech that somebody doesn't like is to have a counter speech and a discussion about the issue. So I can understand and sympathize with somebody who's in that situation, but also need to respect our Constitution.
Yeah, what I would think is it's great that you brought this bill forward, Representative Wisner. I think that what we should do, and particularly in view of the fact that the interdependent resolution is not moving forward, and there's evolving case law, that we might think about how to shape this concept for action down the road in a way that would be narrower. It doesn't intrude on constitutionally protected speech. So if there are any further questions or comments, committee?
Mr. Chair, just again, ladies and gentlemen in the building, it's terrible that we have to do this, but I think it's necessary, and I hope the courts do uphold it. The first case is saying that you can have a law to do this. There were some limitations on the what they could and could not do, but I think it's necessary, and I would be willing to hope that we can get support next session if we're all here.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. Since it has been referenced, could someone enlighten me as to the reason why House Joint Resolution 52 will not be moving forward?
I can't explain that at all. It hasn't been to our committee here.
What is the House Joint Resolution 52? I didn't know. Refers to the vote of the people.
It refers this act to make it in the Constitution, then it would be legal.
And this word of mouth had been reported to me that it was not moving forward, and I just had gotten asked by Representative Wisner to confirm that.
Well, again, and I respect the committee that heard it before, and they heard testimony in support of it. Again, at that point, our question was, what was the federal court's going to rule as far as the federal law and any state implementations of that? So we do have it going through the courts now, and I hope that it does uphold the right to restrict.
Very good. If there's nothing further, then I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3443. Oh, I'm sorry. Did we have you on? Oh, I beg your pardon, Ms. Meyer. I will reopen the public hearing, House Bill 3443.
Maybe you can convince us to pass it. Go ahead.
Now, Chair, McPherson, members of the committee, it's always a possibility if I open my mouth, but I'll hope that that's not the case.
You put that on the record, Andrea.
Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, here in opposition to House Bill 3443. I want to make clear at the outset that much of this legislation around the country has been directed at the activists of Fred and activities of Fred Phelps and his group, and we believe what he's doing is abhorrent. But as Representative Bonamici indicated, free speech includes speech we don't like. Let me try to give, as a lawyer, something I try not to always be, some clarity on the legal issues surrounding this, why this bill has a reference to House Joint Resolution 52, and why the Ohio case in the analysis under the First Amendment is not relevant in Oregon right now. House Bill 3443, as it stands, we believe, for many, many reasons throughout this bill, is entirely unconstitutional under the Oregon Free Speech Provision, Article 1, Section 8. It has been analyzed substantially differently than the First Amendment. The case law is different, and it gives more protections for speech here in Oregon. I do not know for a fact, but can extrapolate from the fact that this has a requirement of passage to HJR 52, that legislative council agreed that this would not fly under our equivalent free expression provision. Therefore, you have House Joint Resolution 52, which amends our free speech provision. Now, I want to be clear, because sometimes when people look at, if they were to pull House Joint Resolution 52, you go, that Ms. Meyer. It simply creates a new section in our Bill of Rights. It doesn't amend Article 1, Section 8. That's left separate. There are two ways we can amend specific provisions in our Bill of Rights, and proposals do both, and they have the same effect, regardless of how you write them. One is to actually take the section and write an exception into it, you know, and amend that actual section. The other is to add a new section that implicitly, by the language in there, modifies another provision. And that's what House Joint Resolution 52 does. Now, I'm going to kind of avoid, you know, federal case law. It's not relevant. But there are some concerns about the legislation briefly, and the laws passed in other states with not even complying with the First Amendment. Because these have been very broad, they can affect people stopping on sidewalks and having conversations, not even knowing there's a funeral, picketing, protesting for wholly other reasons. You know, my own house of worship is in a downtown area. A funeral could be there. Someone could be outside in the street yelling for, because I live right near there, because there's a residential, for entirely other reasons, and not knowing or not trying to or having the effect. So, but I want to talk about something different a little bit briefly before I close, about why we, you know, if the response is we should amend our free speech provision to provide this exception here of Oregon, of why I would urge this legislature not to go there. Since 1996, Oregonians have been asked to weaken our free expression provision in the Oregon Constitution four times. And each time, Oregonians have rejected it. And their ballot measures, their constitutional amendments that you all might think, that sounds great, and you may have supported them, but Oregonians rejected them. In 1994, it was Measure 19 on obscenity and child pornography. Surely not a popular form of speech on its face. Article 1, Section 8 was attempted to be amended on Measure 31 in 1996. Again, rejected. Measure 87 in 2000, a referral that this legislature put out to allow cities and counties to zone sexually oriented businesses, rejected. 2006, I actually have memory of that because it was so recent. Measure 46, that would have amended our free speech provision on campaign finance reform, rejected in every single county, 40% to 60%. Now, I want to point out why I think we can extrapolate from that last vote how precious Oregonians think our Bill of Rights and our free expression provision is to any amendments, that they really don't want them. Measure 47, the companion bill to campaign finance, the statutory scheme, passed. Clearly, one could say voters want something with campaign finance reform. Why then didn't they pass 46 so they could do it? Well, I was involved in polling. I was involved in messaging on 46. And what voters understood and what voters said is we don't want to weaken our free speech provision. We get that. Now, maybe they're sending a message in 47 that we're concerned about campaign finance issues and you should look at other ways, but they made it, as far as I'm concerned, crystal clear to leave our Bill of Rights alone. So we urge you to not proceed. The good thing is Mr. Phelps has not come to Oregon, as far as I know. I don't want to pass laws that invite him here. I don't want to pass laws that invite people like him here who could then sue and challenge these laws and potentially get attorney's fees. I don't want to send any invitation to them. And as has been pointed out, this particular proposal goes to all funerals. Now, be clear, on a cemetery or a house of worship, it's private property. And they can be, folks who are not asked to be there can be escorted out. We are talking about public property. And be it the Patriot Riders who come out in support or others who might have other reasons or people who are just engaged in other lawful activities, we urge you to look at other solutions and other ways to deal with speech we don't like. Thank you very much.
Okay. Any questions?
I have a question.
Representative Whistler.
Thank you. So ACLU opposes this.
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett. Yes, the ACLU opposes House 3443 because we believe it violates Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution and is a content-based speech restriction.
Hey, and Mr. Chair, follow on.
Okay.
Mrs. Myers, that group was in Redmond.
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, that's why I tried to qualify. I thought Mr. Phelps might have shown up at one funeral in the state, and I hope he goes far, far away because his speech is abhorrent. And our response to speech we don't like is, as Representative Bonamici said, more speech. More speech about how his pronouncements are intolerable in a society where we believe in the opportunities to grieve.
Thank you.
Okay.
Just make a quick comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Phelps and his followers threatened to come and protest at my daughter's school 2 years ago because they had a photo exhibit about diversity in families that included some same-sex couples in the photographs. And so they were planning to come and protest. Mr. Phelps himself didn't show up, but I have to say it encouraged quite a bit of discussion among the school community about how wrong his methods were, because he was going to come and stand outside of a school and threaten people, and it did encourage a lot of discussion about free speech rights.
Mr. Chair, they did come to the school in Tobias Reed's district, Southridge, mm-hmm. to protest a play that was there.
Okay, I'm not hearing any more comments or questions. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3443. I'm going to reopen the work session on House Bill 2153 for the purpose of a suspension of the rules to permit Representative Wisnett and Representative Reed to vote on the motion, which was to move House Bill 2153 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. This is the bill that on 3443?
2153.
So we had somebody else who wanted to speak on House Bill 34?
Mr. Chairman?
I'll reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3443.
Committee, Herb Colom, Justice Herb Colom, 2623 Oconee Lane South. I usually let my military representatives speak for me, but I don't see them here. I've heard some argument this morning that an appropriate response for someone who's protesting at a military funeral is a rebuttal argument. A young widow who is putting her husband in the ground is not in a frame of mind that's going to permit her to have a challenged conversation with anyone at that time. And it's just inconceivable to me that we would allow someone to interfere with what's going on at that time in that poor woman's life. I've heard the ACLU arguments. I have not heard them propose anything other than opposing the bill. I have not heard them express something that we could use in place of it. We need to help these people. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Colom, I want to clarify, in no way was, if you're referring to my comment about more speech is usually the best way to deal with speech we don't like, no way meant to imply that a young widow should or is able to rebut someone who's protesting at a funeral. That's not the intent of my comment. And I do believe that if someone was disruptive, that existing laws should be used to address that disruption.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Representative Flores.
Very quick comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your indulgence. Mr. Colom, I'd just like to thank you because I know that you express the heart and sentiment of thousands of Oregonians. So thank you for stepping forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing him to come forward. I'm going to reclose the public hearing on House Bill 3446. We were in work session on House Bill 2153, which is the bill to extend the statute of limitations on sex offenses and where there's DNA evidence. And we had adopted the dash one amendments to the bill. And so I would ask now for suspension of the rules to permit Representative Wisnett and Representative Reed to join the unanimous vote of the committee to report that bill out to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection to that suspension of the rules? not hearing any objection, then the rules are suspended. Then Representative Wisnett and Representative Reed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. We will now reclose the work session on House Bill 2153 and open a work session on House Bill 2131. Council Kalmanson, remind us about this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2131 concerns the address confidentiality program. Before the committee are dash one amendments. I'm just looking for the summary on them. The dash one amendments provide that the new definition of actual address becomes operative on June 1st, 2008. The amendments reinsert a provision that allows a public body to seek a waiver from the ACP requirements. It also allows a court, in the context of an order disclosing an actual address, to address, as much as practicable, the safety and protection of the ACP participant, and also establishes that jury source lists and lists of active electors may not contain information about address confidentiality program participants.
Representative Wisnett.
I move that we have the amendments. Now we have to accept
dash
one amendment into 2131.
Representative Wisnett to move the dash one amendments into House Bill 2131. Is there any discussion? Representative Flores.
Blessings. Just a note that to Jan Coleman, the Yamhill County Clerk, the letter that we have submitted, where she indicates that they had originally been in opposition to the bill due to the provisions of the dash one amendments, their concerns have been addressed. So.
Yeah. So noted. Any further discussion? Any objection to the adoption of the dash one amendments? If not, then the dash one amendments are in.
Mr. Chair, I move that the committee vote on HB 2131 with due pass recommendation to the floor with the as amended.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2131 as amended by the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion of the motion? Then clerk will call the roll.
President Bonamici. Aye. Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Kahn.
Aye.
Representative Krieger excused. Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chairman Ferguson.
Aye. House Bill 2131 as amended moves to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and Representative Wisnett will be the carrier. Close the public work session of House Bill 2131. Pass over House Bill 2132 because Representative Holvey is not here, and take up House Bill 2708. Councilor Kelmanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2708. Was a bill that this committee heard on April 5th. It prohibits provisions in construction agreements that require indemnification for damages caused by negligence. What the bill does is it includes within the definition of construction agreements for the planning and design of a project attached to real estate, so it allows design professionals to have the same protections. There would not be indemnification for damages caused by negligence.
You may remember, committee, that there were several bills that were presented to us recently brought forward by the American Council of Engineering Companies, and this one has been brought back for work session, and it simply prohibits certain indemnification provisions. That is, one party by agreement trying to make another party responsible for what it would have to pay and leaves the true party at issue in the as to the, whatever the alleged liability is rather than shifting it. And there are, it expands an existing provision that is already accomplishes that but expands it to include engineering or design professionals. And there are no amendments to the bill, as I recall.
That's correct.
So, do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2708 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2708 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Kahn.
Aye.
Representative Krieger. Excuse. Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Excused.
And Chairman Ferguson.
Aye.
Off the floor.
House Bill 2708 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Cameron, would you carry that?
Sure.
Thank you very much. Now open a work session on House Bill 2822.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2822 is a bill that this committee heard, which concerns the standards that a presiding officer in a contested case hearing had to use. It essentially says they need to apply law to fact and applies the same standard to administrative law judges. There was some concern that there was a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and the committee, I think correctly, was confused by that referral. There's a, and so we talked to people, and there is no fiscal on this, and the referral has been rescinded. So that's where we are.
Okay. Any discussion of House Bill 2822? Anybody a further refresher on this? It's kind of a technical set of issues, although it is it's actually important in the administrative law setting.
I should add that there were Dash 1 amendments. What I don't remember is whether we already moved them into.
We did not.
So the Dash 1 amendments would need to be moved into the bill as well.
Mr. Chair, I move that the Dash 1s be added to House Bill 2822.
Representative Comp moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2822. Is there any discussion? Any objection? And the Dash 1 amendments are in.
Mr. Chair,
description come?
I move House Bill 2822 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Comp moves House Bill 2822 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, clerk will call roll.
Representative
Bunning.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative
Comp. Aye.
Representative
Barker. Aye. Representative Wisniak.
Excuse. And
Chairman Barker. Aye. House Bill 2822 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Comp, would you carry that? Thank you very much.
Or Mr. Chair,
Representative Richardson.
Well, we offered Representative Richardson, although there wasn't one recent occasion where he was the chief sponsor and chose not to.
Okay, but please do so.
Wound up on the consent calendar, actually, in that case. But I think that this could bear a little bit more explanation than that. So if he does not wish to carry it, then Representative Comp.
I will. Yes.
Very good. Thank you very much. Well, that concludes our agenda. I am going to roll over into our next meeting further the work session on House Bill 3182, because I'd understood from Representative Holby that he was working on amendments to it that might draw sufficient support. So that will be up on Monday if he brings those amendments forward. That's the rest of our agenda. Thank you very much for your patience and diligence, committee. We've been working overtime to get this done. We're adjourned.